Yeah. Well, if you really think about this, like people in your audience, right? You got probably young people thinking about like, okay, I want to get into real estate. I want to do this. Dude, it doesn't matter. Whatever you want to do besides being in a nine to five job, you have to be so callous from hearing the word no. In fact, it's probably, it's different than that. You have to almost crave the word no. You have to crave the hard work. And I was listening to a buddy of mine, Alex Hormozi. You guys know Alex, he's blown up the last like 3 years.
Sorry.
He says, imagine creating the most badass human being. Like you have to create this human being. What would you have to do? And what would you have to put that human being through in order to make them the person you want them to be? It's probably not a very chill life, right? Like you're not just giving them a chill life. Like, okay, you know, here's an iPhone and here's an iPad and here's a this and here's a that and here's every script and here's everything that you have. It's like, no, dude, the people that are truly the badasses are the ones that are like, my parents made me start working at 15 because they didn't pay for anything for me. It's why more billionaires were like, I started from nothing than people that are like, yeah, my parents were already millionaires. You guys have heard the phrase 1,000 times. Great book, by the way. The Fourth Turning, if you guys have not read that book, it's one of the best books of all time. The phrase basically sum up the book is, you guys have heard this before too. Good times create weak men. Weak men create bad times. Bad times create strong men, and strong men create good times.
And the cycle begins again.
And the cycle begins. And so when you think about it, so it's also about the four seasons. So that book, The Fourth Turning, talks about how there's constantly four seasons of an economy, constantly four seasons of even the social economic ecosystem. And right now, okay, so you have spring, you have summer, and you have fall, which is harvest. So spring is really hard. You're planting seeds. You're doing the thing. Summer, you got to keep everything alive. Like everything that you planted, you got to keep it alive. You got to keep it alive. Protect, 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 protect. And then in fall is the harvest, right? That's where everybody starts making tons of money and things are great. And if you made it through the first two seasons, you can harvest. And then after the harvest comes the winter.
Welcome to Rhea Radio, episode 100.
All snap.
With Pace Morbid.
By popular demand.
It is popular demand, isn't it?
You're listening to Rhea Radio, the nationally trusted name in real estate investing. We dig deep to discover investors' why in real estate. If you want to skip all the BS and get in investors' heads, you're in the right spot. Be one of the thousands to check out RhiaRadio.com.
Man, I am so pumped that we finally got this thing in the books. It's been a moment. It's been an item of stress for us.
100th episode or Pace Morby.
Yes. But we've been talking about this 100th episode for a long time now. Who are we going to get? What are we going to do? Like, now that's all behind us.
Like,
now
2 years.
Now we can relax a little bit.
Yeah,
right?
Ted was on episode one. He was like, who are you going to get for episode 100?
And Owen's like, it's not as big of a deal as you think. I'm like, it is a big deal, Owen.
It's been occupying Ted's mental space for a long time now.
But he actually said it too in the podcast. He was like, no, your podcast has now started. Like, you've reached 100. It starts from now.
Yeah. Now we're at ground zero.
Exactly.
So here we are, reborn, Rhea Radio.
I tell you what, nothing was more stressful than planning the 100th episode party that we threw.
Oh my goodness.
That was the, I was like looking back on that. Actually, the whole time I was doing it, I'm like, what the heck was I thinking to put this thing together in this short amount of time?
It was a lovable shit show. Sorry, Carson.
The get all those people. We had 52 people show up to Omaha.
Waiting to be interviewed by us.
Yeah.
In one night, by the way. Good planning, Ted.
It worked out really well.
Oh.
Did it?
Did you see the pictures of my face? It was a logistical nightmare for me. I'm just saying.
Oh my God. I couldn't even imagine.
Your plan was like bad, but my own was like, what the hell is going on? Because I'm running around.
You switched the whole plan right at the last minute, though. You're like, okay, we're gonna go here back and forth. We thought we're doing like one interview back and forth, and they're like, no, you're gonna do a whole table.
That would have been like, imagine going back. That would have been harder for me to do if I was going back and forth between you guys constantly.
So yeah, that would have sucked.
It was an easier like plan for me to be able for you all to do six or five at a time, and then I switch over. That would have been much easier.
But I would never guess that we would have had that many people come down.
Well, what was the final count on the attendance?
I know for a fact that we had at least 175 people, but we could have had as many as 200 people there.
Okay, so to set the stage for those of you listening that weren't there, we had a 100th episode extravaganza. For the Rhea Radio celebration, and Ted parlayed that with the Omaha Rhea in-person meetup, which was, you know, about a month ago, and it was well attended. We invited all of our past 100 guests to participate in this and be interviewed to find out what he'd been up to since we talked to you last. Mm-hmm. Basically, that was the goal. And then Ted was like, well, we'll invite them all and we'll just interview all of them. And I'm like, okay, let's you realize that we literally, if we interviewed everyone, that would be 52 minutes and that would be really rapid fire if we were just asking them one question.
But
that was it.
But originally we thought maybe 30 people would show up.
And then 8 hours later, it was great and chaotic and frenetic and like all of the adjectives you can think of to describe this thing.
But I think I left there at 1 a.m. that night.
Yeah, it was a lot.
It was stressful, but all in all, it was good because, you know, we actually executed it. Like it felt as if it wasn't going to be done. And then we did it and we was like, how did we do this in like a matter of an hour and a half, 2 hours? Like it was.
Oh, it's not an hour and a half. We started recording. We opened doors at 6 and it was almost 10 o'clock when I was getting my final speech at the end.
Yeah, I was talking about the recording time.
Well, and here's, so Ted is always making fun of me for being long-winded, and then Dennis, okay, you. Like I want to get a little kudos for this, for curtailing my amount of time I spent with interviewers, and then we look over at Ted, and I've gone through like 10 people, and Ted's still like talking to the first person.
That is such
I'm just
BS.
Saying he has now made up for all of his lack of interviewing questions. In one night.
Yeah.
So good job. Now I feel like, you know, now
my voice bar is even. My voice is gone. I have a choice. You put me on the spot and I got to talk to people. I'm going to talk.
There you go. Okay. So it was a lot of fun. Thank you again for everybody that made it to that event. It was an awesome thing to see all of you in support of, you know, something that's been, you know, kind of a love child for all three of us here. And we love you guys. Thanks for listening. We've got you think we were fun to listen to on the first 100 episodes. Wait till you hear the next 100, because we're going to have some kick-ass people on this podcast. We're going to have some returning guests that you can see what kind of growth they've been through in the last year. And I'm just psyched to get other people from around the country that we've now gotten to know through our, you know, networking connections and the you know, relationships we've built through Rhea Radio. So thanks again, listeners. This has been awesome. You're going to be treated at some point to some video of Ted when we are on YouTube later this year. So that's going to be it's going to be a lot of fun. You can see all his various facial hair stylings that he has, and it's just gonna be, you guys are gonna,
you gotta
love
see
it.
Ted Lasso, Teddy Bear,
Teddy Bear, Ted Lasso,
John, Ted, everybody, like, you got everybody.
Well, and in the meantime too, we do have the channel set up, so if you go on Rhea Radio on YouTube, you guys can subscribe to it now. We are putting content up there from our meetups, but we are gonna soon have the actual podcast up there, so you'll be able to watch it there. But I also want to shout out to all the sponsors, because we had 18 sponsors in the room,
that
too.
That was really nice. So really well attended. Thank you again for all of your help.
What can people expect from the legendary Pace Morby today?
Man, Pace did everything we hoped and more. He went into a lot of things, I think, that nobody else has ever asked him on podcasts before.
Well, I say this all the time. You and I do our research before we listen to these guys. I probably did about 15 hours of podcast listening, just a Pace being interviewed, not his own podcast. And the content that we pulled out of him was not mentioned in pretty much anything I listened to.
Well, here's the deal on this. So if you want to hear like all of the nuts and bolts and exactly how to conduct a subject to transaction and really get into the nitty gritty, this is probably not one that you're going to walk away from and say, well, that scratched my itch, because we talked to him about life and how he got involved in real estate in general and a lot of other wide ranging topics. We, of course, cover creative finance in, you know, in some depth. But I think this is a just a fun episode where you get to know the guy behind the, you know, the persona that you're used to seeing on social media.
And that's what I was about to add to what it is you were saying. Like, what we did was give you an idea of the framework of what makes up Pace Mobi and how he was able to reach where he was, well, where he is today, based on the experiences in Korea, based on the experiences with being the contractor.
Oh my God, yeah. Like general, he started as a general contractor, yeah. And then this is crazy though. He started working with the iBuyers, so he's yeah. You know, operates in the Phoenix, Arizona market, and he had basically tied in with a lot of the iBuyers that became really popular on the West Coast, where they started basically OfferPad. You've got Zillow got into that game. There's a whole bunch of these that really kind of focused in on a few different markets, in particular Pace's market. And he lined up with them and did all of their rehabs on the houses he was buying. Well, not all of them, but he was one of their main contractors. So that's really crazy. And he made a lot of money during that time, and then learned along the way that, you know, that's basically a job. And as soon as those, you know, employers or, you know, job givers go away, you know, he's got really no wealth.
The first time I ever heard the name Pace Mobi, I was listening to him on some podcast. And don't quote me on this, but I could have sworn he said that at one point he was managing up to 1,000 jobs just for Zillow on rehabs.
Gross. Jesus. Yeah, I could not imagine. That would be a nightmare.
I totally wanted to bring that up. But yeah. It was that point right there. And I was like, who is this guy?
Yeah. So insanely, he has basically almost like an unlimited capacity to handle more and more and more is how it seems, I think, to a lot of people, because this guy's travel schedule is insane.
Insane.
Yeah. And
he's never here. And then when he is here, he's here for like 2 weeks and then he's gone again for like months and then back again.
But he does travel with his kids and Laura. Yeah. And so he brings his wife and kids with him around, which I like.
Which is great. Yeah. But he is just a master of social media content and being so tuned in to his particular niche within real estate, but he doesn't live and die by that is what I also like about him. He's added some other, you know, facets of real estate to his toolbox. So he's, you know, you're going to learn in this episode how he got involved in investing in other asset classes, you know, how he's formed partnerships with people, how he's used social media, like we've talked about already, to his advantage. But he's just grown so fast, so quickly, that it's been just a whirlwind to watch him. He's got a new book that was published by Bigger Pockets. You'll find out the title and what that was all about in the episode. He's just a neat guy, man. Like I love Pace. I like all of his stuff out there. I was particularly intrigued on what his attachment was to the game of golf. And I don't think many people have ever talked about that, but you'll find out what that is in the episode as well. So,
were you the one that asked him about how much money he makes on YouTube?
Yes.
I think it was you.
Yeah.
And
ooh, that'll be interesting.
Just wait for the answer because, oh my God, it's going to blow your mind.
You know, we were talking a lot about, you know, what you're going to get out of this episode. And what came to mind is how much we've morphed over the last 100 episodes. I was going to say 100 years, but how we've had morphed.
I don't know why you were looking at me when you said that.
100 years. Okay. And I was thinking that how we have started, you know, in those first 10 episodes, if you listen to us, how specifically we're just like copy of what BP was, you know, like on a, just in Omaha. And then we decided, hey, we're going to go national. And then we decided, you know, hey, let's be us. And then we found out really our niche is finding the background of these people.
I am so happy that nothing against Bigger Pockets, because they are great. I mean, all of us benefited from them and still benefit from them. But I am so glad that we found our lane. And that we unapologetically just went down that lane, and we're like, it doesn't matter if it's a 3-hour interview, it doesn't matter if it's an hour and a half interview, like we would do it, we would get it done, and then we would make it into something great, man. It has been great so far, so I'm just so happy that we did that.
What's an hour and a half interview?
Right? That's a chat over lunch. That's what it is.
We'll have to wrap this up here shortly, but I do want to mention that there is a, like, you have to tune into this to figure out what Pace's association with Flemish bunnies is. I had never heard of these in my life before.
I was mind blown.
Before researching this. So Google Flemish bunnies and then listen to this episode and you're going to get probably a laugh out of this whole scenario. So, but with that, how about we get into today's
golden nugget.
Today's golden nugget is, in the vein of creative finance, since we have the man, the myth, the legend, Pace Morby as our guest today, we thought we'd mention, when you're going out and making offers, so we're in a weird time right now, right? Like, it's interest rates have been like going haywire for the last, you know, year at least. And a lot of people seem like they're kind of standing pat in the market. They're afraid to make offers. There's a lot of deals that have slowed down. Velocity of transactions has cratered. So all that being said, don't forget about the fact that now is probably one of the best times in history to make creative finance offers. So if you don't understand creative finance and how, like, if you're version of buying a property involves going to a bank, getting a mortgage and paying retail price or some flavor of that, and then taking the deal down and doing whatever you're going to do and then keeping it or flipping it or whatever, you need to dial into this, because you're doing yourself a disservice if you don't focus on other methods of disposition in acquiring properties. Specifically, right now is one of the best times in history that I can remember, but even going back further than that, I think history will tell you that creative finance in times of rising interest rates is one of the best ways to buy properties. And Pace's method, his main method that he's known for is taking over properties subject to the existing financing. Now, when you're making an offer on a property, whether it's off market, on market, whatever the deal is, you can make more than one offer at one time. So you can make a cash offer in hopes that you're going to get a cash offer with a quick close in hopes that you're going to get a big discount on the repair value or the after repair value of the property, and then do whatever you're going to do with it, and then do whatever, you know, sell it, flip it, rent it, whatever. But if you make a subject to offer, you have to provide some explanation on how that's beneficial to the seller. So I think you need to get educated on that part of the puzzle of the environment we're in now. And I think if you follow Pace and you study what he offers from a content perspective, you're going to leverage yourself into much, you know, many more deals than you would otherwise if you only had like a hammer and it's a nail. So I think make more than one offer when you're approaching a seller that's motivated, because a lot of times investors come up and they say, this doesn't have much equity in it, so I'm walking away. But guess what? If there's a 3 or 3.5% interest rate, you've got something there.
Yeah.
The interest rate is the value.
Mm. To add to this gold nugget also, if you really want to dig deep in this, on Tuesday, November 7th, we will be hosting Creative 101, an intro to subject to and creative real estate financing here in Omaha. And Travis Banks is going to be presenting that one at our local RIA group. So definitely check that out. Personal friends with Pace Morby, and he's going to do a real deep dive in all this.
So this is actually going to be our last intro that we're recording before we go to BPCon, all three of us again. Mm-hmm. Avengers Unite.
I'm excited about that.
So hopefully we'll report back if there's any scooters or hash houses or gay bars that Ted wants to take us to. So we don't know what's on the horizon for us, but
Tony Brown said that he has this really good all you can eat buffet that he wants to take all of us to. So
I'm in too. We do have a RIA Radio Snapchat channel, so we'll be posting some of the Snapchats on there.
Yeah. Oh, God, please. I didn't know this.
We've had it for like a year and a half.
I think that we should do scooters every time we go to...
That's our thing now?
Yeah.
Okay, scooters?
So. Yeah. Not the coffee. No.
You were right, not scooters. The
coffee. Yes.
Oh, my God. All right. Well, we'll live stream that if it happens.
That video is on our Instagram channel if you want to watch that one, too.
That was perilous.
Well, with that, let's get into the 100th episode, Pace Morby.
Pace, the first question I've got for you today is, how do you say creative finance in Korean?
I actually don't know that. So nobody's ever asked me that question. It's probably Koreans, they don't say McDonald's, they say McDonald's. So like it'd be some bastardization of the actual word. It'd be like some funny way of saying creative finance, but it sounds part English, part Korean, probably.
Why did you pick Korean as a language to learn?
That's the thing is I'm LDS Mormon. Most people know us as Mormon, and you submit a request to go on a mission. And what they do, the church goes through like your academics. They go through, are you an Eagle Scout? Did you do all these things? What's your background? Are you smart enough to learn another language? Right. And so it's a compliment when they choose you to go speak another language. Cause like, okay, this guy at least is smart enough to, we can send him out into a third world country and he can learn some random language. Right. So when I got my mission call, you don't know, it's random. And so what happens is like the Mormons in the culture, we all get together and everybody's like, oh my gosh, Pace got his mission call. So this big envelope shows up in the letter or in the mail and it's massive and it has just one letter in it. And the letter says where you're going. It's like, we are proud to tell you that you have been called to serve to blankety blank, 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 blank. And so I had like 100 people around me. I was 18 years old. I get this thing from the church. I'd submitted my papers like 90 days prior and I get the envelope and everybody's around me in my living room. We couldn't even fit all the people in. And I open it up and I pull out the mission call and it says, you have been called to serve in Seoul, Korea. And I reply and I was like, oh my gosh, I'm going to Brazil. and my dad's like, what are you talking about? It says Seoul, Korea. And I was like, what's Korea? Isn't that a city in Brazil? He's like, dude, that's a country, you idiot. So I had no choice, and nor did I even know what it was when I got called to it. So there you go.
And now you had to go there for what? Is it 2 years that you have to go?
2 years, yeah. You can choose to go 23 months or 25 months because there's like these transfer things that happen all the time where missionaries are exchanging with missionaries. And so what you do is you're always paired in with another companion. And I had 18 companions over my 25 months. And on the last transfer of your mission, the way it works is that you're either in the country for 23 months, or you can say, I want to go home late. I want another transfer. So I chose another transfer. It was another 6 weeks. Cause I was like, what am I going to do? I'm 18 years old. I'm now at this point, you're 21. I'm 21. Why not stay in Korea for 6 more weeks now that I understand and speak the language and I can just be really lazy the last 6 weeks and just like actually see the country. So I stayed 25 months in Korea, yeah.
What was that like? 2 years in Seoul, Korea or in the country? Like
a lot of ways it was horrible. I think, you know, it's like when you go through really tough times, the only thing you remember are the good things.
Mhm.
And it's like being poor. You talk about, oh, you know, my family was poor and that meant you got to hang out with your siblings a lot more and mom and dad were around a lot more. Like I look at a lot of people that live in our neighborhood. You know, we live in a neighborhood of 9 houses. Like it's this very private subdivision. Or it's like a private custom community. And you never see the kids go outside and play. You never see the parents hanging out with their kids. And then you go to like a poor neighborhood and it's like the kids are at the playground or doing this. And the parents are doing all the free stuff, right? So even though you grow up poor, you have in some ways even a more exciting and amazing childhood. So it's kind of like that when you're in your mission, you don't have any money. You can't enjoy nice food or you can't go to restaurants that you would normally see on like a Yelp review. You know, you don't have a cell phone. You don't have any like real nice accommodations. I slept on the floor for 2 years. Korea has a massive cockroach problem. So like mm-hmm. you wake up in the night with cockroaches climb for 2 years.
Ew, right? I didn't know that.
Oh yeah, it's a massive problem. It's just so humid there and these bugs just live in a big, big way. So you sleep on the floor. And the reason you sleep on the floor is because they don't have centralized air conditioning. And so what you do is you sleep on the floor because all the heat runs through the floor. And so you're, even though it's like freezing in your room, you're sleeping on a floor that's really warm because there's hot water rolling through the concrete, right?
Wild.
Oh, it's so wild. And so I ate rice for three meals a day, kimchi 3 meals a day. So of course I love Korean food more than anything. And it was really amazing from the standpoint of I learned skills that other people just don't get to learn from 18 to 21 years old, which is how do you go talk to people about a challenging topic for 2 straight years? How do you knock 10,000 doors and get told no 9,900 and, you know, whatever amount of times? You get told no for straight 2 years and you get spit on. I had this Korean guy. every day I would walk by this place. For about a week, I would walk by this place and this guy would come out and almost attack us every single day. And I was like, okay, I'm going to start going around this the long way so I don't get beat up or punched or whatever. And this guy figured out how to time me perfectly to come in and spit right in my ear.
What?
Yeah. Yeah. They just hated, you know, you're a religious person in another country. So they're like, get the hell out of our country, you piece of crap. Don't you know that we're Buddhists? What are you doing here? So you get to the, at the time, you're like, this is horrible. But you very quickly forget the pain and the anguish and the trauma that you went through. And you, now when you have things happen to you at a later age, you're like, that doesn't bother me. I've had people spit in my ear in Korean and, you know, punch me in the face and pull on my, I'd have people pull on my necktie. I had this guy one time grabs my necktie by my his left hand and uppercuts me with his right hand. Just like, boom.
That's a power move.
A freaking power move. And I respect it, you know, first and foremost. So I you know, you knock 10,000 doors for two straight years and every day you have KPIs. This is what happened. Every day as a missionary, you have to call mission headquarters in Seoul. I'm like in some rice paddy field in the middle of nowhere. And they call you every night and they go, how many doors did you knock? How many people did you talk to? How many people did you set up appointments with? Think about the KPIs associated with that and how that gets ingrained in your head for two straight years. And then you go into business later and people go, man, how did you learn how to just crush it in business? I'm like, I don't know. And then when you really think about it, you're like, oh my gosh, I was ingrained to be successful by just being told no.
Dude, I was sitting there thinking, we were talking, I don't know why, about Kirby vacuum sales.
Hell yeah. Those guys,
that's how my parents, badasses. Yeah, it's just, it reminded me of that. Like that, I didn't even think about it that way, but that is probably, I would guess that is probably the hardest job in the world.
Why do you think?
If you're walking around trying to convince people to like
buy a vacuum.
Yeah. Well, that and change your religion. Maybe one of the other.
Oh yeah. I'm selling. Hi, knock, knock, knock. I'm trying to sell you on Jesus and you need to get baptized.
Yeah.
Why do you think, by the way, the church is going to ask for 10% of all your income for the rest of your life.
Why do you think my mom's my best real estate salesperson on my team?
Yeah, no kidding. Good.
She did Kirby sales her whole life.
Oh, she did Kirby sales? Oh, yeah. She's a badass.
Yeah, my parents met working at Kirby, and then she was a manager at Kirby and ran the call center for a while.
That's fun.
Yeah. Well, if you really think about this, like people in your audience, right? You got probably young people thinking about like, okay, I want to get into real estate. I want to do this. Dude, it doesn't matter. Whatever you want to do besides being in a nine to five job, you have to be so callous from hearing the word no. In fact, it's probably, it's different than that. You have to almost crave the word no. You have to crave the hard work. And I was listening to a buddy of mine, Alex Hormozi. You guys know Alex, he's blown up the last like 3 years.
Totally.
He says, imagine creating the most badass human being. Like you have to create this human being. What would you have to do? And what would you have to put that human being through in order to make them the person you want them to be? It's probably not a very chill life, right? Like you're not just giving them a chill life. Like, okay, you know, here's an iPhone and here's an iPad and here's a this and here's a that and here's every script and here's everything that you have. It's like, no, dude, the people that are truly the badasses are the ones that are like, my parents made me start working at 15 because they didn't pay for anything for me. It's why more billionaires were like, I started from nothing than people that are like, yeah, my parents were already millionaires. You guys have heard the phrase 1,000 times. Great book, by the way. The Fourth Turning. If you guys have not read that book, it's one of the best books of all time. The phrase basically sum up the book is, you guys have heard this before too. Good times create weak men. Weak men create bad times. Bad times create strong men, and strong men create good times.
And the cycle begins again.
And the cycle begins. And so when you think about it, so it's also about the four seasons. So that book, The Fourth Turning, talks about how there's constantly four seasons of an economy, constantly four seasons of even the social economic ecosystem. And right now, okay, so you have spring, you have summer, and you have fall, which is harvest. So spring is really hard. You're planting seeds. You're doing the thing. Summer, you got to keep everything alive. Like everything that you planted, you got to keep it alive. You got to keep it alive. Protect, 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 protect. And then in fall is the harvest, right? That's where everybody starts making tons of money and things are great. And if you made it through the first two seasons, you can harvest. And then after the harvest comes the winter. And you buckle down. And this is where like the depressions happen. And 2008 happens and these economic destructions. the book, The Fourth Turning, is talking about how our the people in our society have gotten so weak, have gotten so entitled. Everything's about people's feelings. It's like, you hurt my feelings. You did this, that, and the other. You don't, you're not calling me by the right pronoun or this, that, and the other. That this book talks about, that is a requirement for us to go through in order for us to go into the winter, in order for us to go back into spring. People like other countries love their country. Right now, we have a problem in our country where Americans are starting to criticize America. That's called entitlement. You are in the greatest country of the world. You have been given the harvest. You weren't there for spring and summer and fall. You are just here in fall, and people are giving everything to you. So social checks and this, that, and the other. So we've created all these weak people. And when I get these 20-year-olds and 23-year-olds and 24-year-olds come up to me and go, Pace, how do I get started in real estate? I'm like, what have you done hard in your life? Tell me, let's start there. Oh, I went to high school and then my parents paid for my college and now I'm here. I want to get started in real estate. I'm like, the biggest thing is not strategy for you. The biggest thing is going to be mindset for you. You're going to be upset when somebody tells you no. You're going to be upset when you don't see success in a week. You're going to be upset because of these things, because all you've seen is the harvest of life. All you've been doing is given feast after feast after feast. You've never gone through the crap. And I know you guys agree with this. You see the young kids nowadays don't even want to get their driver's license, dude. Like, I had
this conversation yesterday about somebody.
It's crazy. I'm like, dude, I was begging my parents, like, can I just drive the car? My dad would be like, yeah, just take, yeah. And so my dad's like, we'll let you get your driver's license, but you got to go buy your own car. Like, my parents didn't go 50-50 with me on a car. My parents were like, go buy your own damn car. So I went and bagged groceries at Smith's to get a freaking car. And my car was $500. It was a Ford Taurus. And my CD player was $600. That kind of tells you, you know, I'm gonna buy something that barely runs so I can put a badass CD player in it.
I had an 82 Citation with some 15-inch Hyphonic subs in the back, man. Bro, I mean, that has back. So I get you.
Yes. And you spent more time, like, you know, figuring out, how do I run the amp? How do I run the wire? Oh my gosh, I just blew a fuse. Like, we figured things out at a younger age. Kids nowadays, dude, it's like they're inside playing video games. They're just harvesting all the hard work that the country has put in for the last, you know, 50, 60 years. They're spoiled. And so no, people are like, there's no tradesmen. You guys have a hard time finding tradesmen?
Yes.
Right.
For sure. Yes, for sure.
So that the book, The Fourth Turning, actually talks about how this has happened over and over and over in society for the last 3,000 years, and it's predictable. And what will happen next is we'll have a winter. This whole entire thing will collapse, and it's actually the greatest thing you could even imagine for people that are prepared and understand that a winter is coming around the corner.
God, you know, I'm coaching my son's fourth grade football team right now. And it's like all these kids come into the football game and practice and they think that they're all pro football players.
Yeah, dude.
And it's tackle football. And I'm like, and every time I looked over at one point yesterday during practice, and five kids are sitting on the sideline and they're all like, oh, I'm injured. My head hurts. This is happening. My throat hurts. And I'm like, guys, it's just time to man up. I mean, are these injuries or are these boo-boos? and they're like, they're boo-boos. I'm like, you think that all these guys you look up to right now didn't have a hard time and didn't do conditioning to get to where they need to be?
Dude, think about Michael Jordan's flu game. You guys remember when Michael Jordan had the flu? And you look into the deep story of that history. He was food poisoned, right? So the other team that was playing them, they food poisoned his pizza that was delivered to him, and he got sick. He was throwing up. He had to sit on the toilet every 20, 30 minutes, just liquid going through him on both ends, right? He goes, has the greatest game of the year, scores like 60-something points while he has food poisoning. And I tell people all the time, Michael Jordan wasn't the best player that we've ever seen because of all the shots he made or all the rings he got. He was the greatest player because he made the difficult look easy. And he didn't complain. He didn't bitch. He didn't moan. He didn't say, oh, I'm sick. I'm going to sit this game out. He's like, no, that's even more of a reason I need to stomach up. This is my job, and I'm not going to bellyache and complain about it. I'm just going to do my job. And again, this is what happens with me too, right? I have a girl that's doing house stuff around our house. We just hired this girl, and this is about 2 months ago. And I asked her, hey, can you go outside and you know, pull the garbage cans in. You know, I'm about to jump on a podcast. Can you pull the garbage cans in? Like, I can't believe I have to ask you. This is on your job responsibility, but whatever. I'll ask you. I go, hey, can you pull the trash cans in? The wind blew over two of the four garbage cans. Can you go pull those in? She says, yeah, I'll do that tomorrow. It's hot right now. I'm like, what? It's 20 seconds. Like, you're literally pulling them in and you're done. Like, so she sat in the kitchen on her phone for an hour until she had something else to do. And I'm just like, my parents taught me different, dude. My parents taught me there's no idle time. You don't sit, there's no downtime, right? You go find things to do. You create value. You don't wait for somebody to tell you what to do. You find out valuable things to go and create.
I tell you what, I look at how I was raised, and I'm 43. I was very open range. I wanted to be outside. I didn't want to come in. I didn't want the streetlights to turn on, so I had to come home. You know what I mean? And to get my kids to go outside, I mean, I literally am to the point now where I turn off the internet because I can turn off to their devices, and I will turn the devices off. I'm like, hey, you know what? You got to get yours done. Get it done. You know what? It's your job to do the filters. Well, what are you going to pay me for that? I'm not going to pay you because it's part of living in a home. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not paying me for your mom doing your laundry, are you? There's always that balance.
It's an interesting thing because here's the thought process, right? The thought process is we have gone through the spring. Like, your parents went through the spring, right? They planted the seeds for you. They protected the seeds for you. Like, your mom, think about what she did with Kirby Sales, right? She was out planting the seeds, learning the sales skills, developing herself to create opportunity for her son. Her son now comes onto the scene in summer, right? So you learn how to protect the harvest. You learn how to do all these things. You work really hard. Now, guess what, bro? You're in fall right now. So am I. So my kids are harvesting what my parents planted. Mm-hmm. Right. So there's this thought process of like, I want to teach my kids how to be an entrepreneur. Okay. Well, this is something I'm going through right now. I don't have all the facts, but I'm going through what you're going through too.
Yeah.
You have this thought process of, I want to give my kids more than what I had. Okay. Well, what I'm just coming to the realization of since I read the book, The Fourth Turning, if I want my kids to have more than I have to teach them how to create more than I created. Not receive the things that I created. And that truly is the gift that you have to give your kids. And I just learned this and I'm like, shit. Because what I've done is I've gone to my kid, I'm like, all right, we're going to start a YouTube channel for you. I'm going to use my editors. We're going to do this. I'm going to go help you buy a trailer on creative finance. We're going to document it. I'm going to get some money coming in. So now when I ask my son to do things around the house, he'll do it, right? If I ask him. But the problem is he's got $16,000 sitting in his bank account at age 15 because of a trailer I helped him go out and do and YouTube channel that's coming in. And now he's got money coming in on the YouTube channel. And I've basically just given him the harvest. I never taught him about planting the seed and protecting the crop. And so I'm like, you know what, man? I was talking to my buddy, Jerry Norton. I don't know if you guys know Jerry Norton in real estate.
No. He's out of Kansas City, right?
You guys are in that bubble. That's good. Jerry's got like 600,000 subscribers on YouTube. He's a good person to follow. He's a great guy. So Jerry's like, you know, he makes great money. I think Jerry last year cleared like $10 million, right? He does big luxury flips, makes really, really good money. And I'm like, dude, how are you setting up your estate plan? Like, how are your kids going to receive this? How are you going to do it? And he's like, Mike, what? You're giving money to your kids? He's like, that's the greatest way to spoil your kids. My kids will never create anything if I just give them stuff. What are you talking? Are you crazy? But what's funny is like, as parents, we want to be good parents. And so what I've done is I've given my children opportunity, but I've given them the wrong opportunity. This is something I got to go back and fix because I've just come to the realization of this, which is I should give you the opportunity to have cockroaches climb on you while you're sleeping in Korea for 2 years. I should give you the opportunity to go out and go find your own trailer. And I should require you to do certain things. And no, hell no. You're making dinner tonight. You're doing this. Like, are you kidding me? My parents never did any of that stuff. If I wanted school clothes, I had to go buy my own school clothes. Now it's like, hey, let's go down to here. Let's spend $500 on you. Let's get you some new shoes. We even caught ourselves the other day with my son. I go, hey man, how are you doing on shoes? He's like, oh, I'm good. I got all the things. And I go, are you growing out of any of those shoes? Let's go buy you some new shoes. Like, I'm trying to find new reasons to give him more of the harvest. Instead of saying, you know what, dude, we're going to pull it down to one shoe. We're going to pull it down to this. You want stuff? I'm going to give you a list of things you can do to earn what I've given you. But he's 15 now. Like, I might have missed the window of opportunity. But the argument is also I have 3 more years with him. So again, if I want to give my kids more than I had, I have to teach them how to create more than I created.
Peace. Sorry. Is there some sort of a... This is a ghost in the background that's talking to you right now.
It's a Wizard of Oz here.
I'm like, wait, what? What the hell?
But is there some sort of fear for resentment if you do that? Like, are you afraid that your child or children are going to resent you for putting them through hard times?
I don't care. I think that's my new realization. I cared so much about like how my kids love me and I want my kids to be my friend. But then you listen to Jordan Peterson. He's like, your kids are not your friends and you're not meant to be your friends with your kids. You first and foremost, you're their parent. And this is not knowledge I've had for years. This is like last 4 months, I'm coming to this realization and I'm watching the people that are really truly setting their kids up for success. My job as a parent is to make my kid a worthy citizen of our society, not to make them my friend. If I did something wrong, I was fearful my dad was going to spank me.
Yeah.
If I did something wrong, I was afraid of my dad. I was afraid of doing something wrong. There was a fear component there. My kids, it's like, oh, buddy, no worries, man. Just try harder next time. Now think about this as when we grow older, there is real implications of doing things wrong here, right? If you're not a good business owner and you're not a good steward of your business, you're going to lose your business. That is a massive downfall of doing things wrong. What are my kids being taught when they do something wrong? What I think is the biggest fear of me now, just from the last 4 months of acquiring this new perception and viewpoint, is I'm afraid of seeing my kids at 23 years old and still living in my house.
Yeah, I'm terrified of that too.
I told my kids already, I was like, you guys will not have a house here unless you're in college. You're 18, you're out unless you're in school.
Yeah, I love that. So like for me, I'm like, I want to look at my kids dominating and winning in all sorts of regards. I would rather them hate my guts but be successful than have them not successful but be latched onto daddy for the rest of their lives.
We talked about this a handful of times, kind of like in our viewpoints have all changed. I know they have. Where when we started this a couple of years ago, we said, hey, you know, or at least I said, I'm like, hey, I want to give each one of my kids a house. And then I'm like, you know what? After like, you know, it's kind of like that Brandon Turner method. You know, a lot of us got those ideas from there. But after interviewing people, I'm like, you know what? That's not the best decision. You know, what's best is to say that I would like to have one of my kids earn a property that they can buy from me at whatever I have invested in it. But my goal is to teach them. They need to prove to me that they can manage it and that they can handle the rental and they deserve the right if they're 18, 16, 18, or 25. But I'm not going to give it to them. But whatever I paid for it, they can buy it from me and I will be the bank for them.
I love it. I love all that. Here's something I've recently changed with my son Asher. Okay. Because before I was giving him the harvest, right? So what I did is I said, look, you got to get a job. You're 15. It's time to get a job. He started crying. Guys, I'm not joking you. He cried.
And you laughed.
What does that tell you about me when I was 15, I was begging to get a job. I'm like, yeah,
me too.
Let me paint the fascia. Let me clean the gutter. Let me do whatever. I gotta get this $20 to take so-and-so on a date. Cause back then, obviously I could take somebody on a date for $40.
Mm-hmm. Now Taco Bell costs $40.
I was literally, we went and got sandwiches 2 nights ago and I was like, $55? What? Anyway,
so stupid. Yeah.
I'm sounding old. So what I've done now is I went to my son. I go, look, I don't mind giving you an opportunity. I'll open up a door for you, but you need to go work underneath Giselle in my company. She's your boss. You don't report to me. You report to Giselle. You punch your time clock. You do your thing. What I want you to do, there's two big things I'm doing with him. One, he's working underneath Giselle. He's learning how to do video editing on my media team. And what he has to do with that, he gets paid hourly. So he's learning how to trade time for money. So he understands the difference, right? And he's now currently trading time for money. he also gets to be in an environment with other people that don't have the same opportunity as him. So he can hear the way they talk and hear the way they think and this, that, and the other. So he knows, again, the difference. And he then has to take what he learned and he has to go and teach the children of my sub two community. So we're starting a Discord where he now has to take what he just learned at his 9-to-5 job and go to other kids that are 13, 14, 15, 16 years old and teach them how to do video editing and show them how to, and give them a leg up. So he learned servitude, right? Then the second thing that we're doing is the money that my son now has in his account. He just bought a sub two deal that I found. I go, I'll sell this house to you, but you have to use the 16 grand that's in your account. I'm going to get paid an assignment fee on this deal and you're going to be in charge of this property. But more important to all of that, you don't get the profits. This is an investment that gets held onto until you're 25 and your sisters and the siblings underneath you, they get their equal share of your hard work. And he's like, well, how is that fair? And I said, I'm going to tell you something. When you get married and you're in charge of a family, that is your job. Your job is to provide for other people. And so right now at age 15, I'm going to teach you how to invest for other people, not for yourself. And so now he's all excited. And my sister, or his little sister, Corbin, she's like, I'm so excited. When are we going to go over to our house and see how the Airbnb is doing? She's five, right? And Asher, I caught him a couple of times going, our house, that's my house. I'm like, okay, cool. So this is good learning experience. I go, bro, let me tell you something. When you have a wife and you rub it in her face, like this is my money and this is our, this is my, this. And is she going to appreciate that? So I'm finding ways to educate him ahead of time, even though he's in the harvest phase of my life. And if he resents me for it, then I'm okay with it. I resent my dad like a little, I'm like the little bitch that I am inside of me. I'm like, my dad did this and my dad did this. But you know what? I find myself on stage frequently thanking my dad for turning me into somebody who enjoys and craves hard work. I love hard work, just like you two guys do. You wake up and you're excited about work. I think that was the number one thing my parents gave me was the excitement and the craving of hard work.
Hey, I want to ask you something, Pace. So you got back from your mission trip to South Korea. Mm-hmm. You're probably, 21 years old by that time?
Yeah, I'm 21 years old, yeah.
And did you go right into college? Because you went to Utah State University, like any good Mormon boy would do. Yeah. And you played on a snow golf team? What the hell is that?
Oh, that's such a weird thing. Yeah, there was in Utah, you can't golf half the year. So what you do is you get like GPS balls.
Okay.
And you go play in the snow on golf courses and they like sweep off the greens. And then you're basically tracking your ball half the game of like, where'd my ball land in the snow? And you have to find your ball in the snow and you hit the next shot. So yeah, snow golf team. That's what you do in
this
Utah.
Is what I need. Yeah, exactly. I go through a whole case of balls every time.
Seriously, you need those balls. They've had them for like 20 years. Those have been out for like 20 years.
Okay, now this leads up to another thing I wanted to ask you about, which is Dixon Golf.
Yeah.
So I love golf. I'm a big golfer. And I know about Dixon Golf, and they have golf balls, apparel. They're more like eco-friendly than normal golf balls. You want to maybe describe how did that happen real quick? If you wouldn't mind, just give us a quick overview on what that is.
Yeah. So this was right after the crash of 2008. I owned a manufacturing company. I was a part owner of a manufacturing company and it imploded because of 2008, right? Our main customer was think about somebody who's up in Canada or North Dakota, South Dakota, that's pulling oil out of the ground. And they were buying big tanks from us, massive, 16,000 gallon steel tanks from us. And that's what we had. We had 250 welders working for us. We were doing about $30 million a year in revenue. And I'm 22, 23 years old, and I own 10% of this company. And the way I own 10% of the company is I actually did my first real estate deal. I made 180 grand on it. I took all $180,000 and put it into the company and bought ownership in this company. Okay. And the economy implodes. A price of a barrel of oil went from $150 a barrel to $22 a barrel almost overnight, right? Back in 2008. It was chaos, pandemonium. People talk about the real estate market crash. Dude, every, you guys remember this, mm-hmm. everything crashed. If you were in construction, you had no work. You had, it was so bad, right? It was so, so, so bad. So much worse than anybody can really describe. And so, I even wrote like a suicide letter. I was going to kill myself. It was bad. Like it was really, really bad. I just lost my brother, like a year prior. I was going through, something at the time with my wife, the wife at the time, she, as a Mormon boy, we want to have kids. My wife was like, I don't want to ever have kids. And so I was going through that, going through the implosion of the company, all this kind of stuff. And I go, all right, well, I'm going to go to Arizona and I'm going to go find opportunity in Arizona. And I bump into these two guys named Dane and William, and they had this cool golf company. And I was just getting into golf at the time. And I was like, man, all right, tell me about this. And they go, it's eco-friendly thing and da-da-da-da. And I go, guys, we could make this big. And they're like, what do you mean we? You're just some random guy. I go, let me come in and pitch you a couple of ideas. And I thought, I can get some celebrities involved in this thing. We could get a whole bunch of stuff going. We could imagine we could be the official golf ball of the Phoenix Open. Like I was thinking that big. Mm-hmm. So I went in, I pitched them, and they go, well, in order to do all of this stuff you want to do, we'd have to raise a bunch of money. So this is the first time I ever had to raise money in my life. I go, all right, if I can raise money for this company, can I get 51% ownership of this company? And they go, yeah. So for 2 years, I was 25, 26, 27. For 2 years, I was running around the country raising money for this company and helping with the marketing aspect and rebranding things and all that kind of stuff. And then we just, I loved it. It was like, I was obsessed with golf. I ended up joining the country club I'm still a member of today, Mesa Country Club. I just got obsessed with golf. I got obsessed with the people that were in golf. And I started creating all sorts of cool things. Like we have this thing called the Dixon Challenge. You know, you go to like a tournament and there's a cute girl on a par three and they say, hey, do you want to pay $10 for this challenge type of thing? That was something I came up with. That was an idea I came up with that helped get our company off the ground, was selling franchises of these people all over the country running challenges at local charity tournaments. And all of a sudden everybody knew about golf, Dixon Golf. Our girls were, it was like bootstrapping marketing. It was like having people paying us to get our product in their hand through a challenge at a charity tournament. It was freaking genius. And next thing you know, we're in the PGA Tour Superstore. We're in multiple golf stores. We were in retail. Next thing you know, we get a call from Waste Management Phoenix Open. And they go, we want you to be the official ball of the Waste Management. We want, you know, the floating sign on the lake at the Waste Management mm-hmm. Phoenix yep. Open? That is full of my golf balls.
that you personally hit in there.
I wish.
The lake on a
but we made this massive sign for the floating lake, the Waste Management sign. And when you look at that, it's all just hundreds of thousands of balls in this massive sign. And we donated all these balls. We spent some money. And we became the official ball of the Waste Management Phoenix Open. For like 3 years, like everything came to fruition. It was just so freaking amazing. I had so much fun doing it. The problem is I wasn't making really any money. You know, me personally, as the founder, one of the founders of this new company, I just wasn't making money. And I was like, one of the guys I ended up raising money from, his name is Jeff Dumas. Jeff Dumas comes to me. He's like, dude, you work so freaking hard. This company's taken off. You got Don Cheadle. You got, you guys know Don Cheadle. He's, you know, Iron Man sidekick, you know, all that stuff. Like I'm flying around the country with them. He's one of our ambassadors. Samuel Jackson's one of our ambassadors. I'm hanging out with Samuel Jackson. All these amazing things are happening. But then I'm constantly looking at my bank account. And I now at this point, I'm dating my current wife, Laura, but I have no money. Like I'm constantly out of money because we're always reinvesting everything to grow this company. And Jeff Dumas comes to me. He's like, dude, I'm going to teach you. You should go out and start flipping some houses because you could make a couple $100,000 a year on the side while running your golf company. And I was like, all right. So I go and flip one house. Obviously, I have a construction background from my parents. And I'm like, dude, this is what I was meant to do. I was meant to do real estate. I got obsessed with that. And I went to my partners at Dixon Golf and I go, I'm going to relinquish 40% of the ownership of this company. I want to retain 10%. So I still own 10% of Dixon Golf to this day, but Dane and William are now 90%. And I went off and did my own thing. And they thought I was crazy at the time. But now William and Dane, they send me text message every once in a while. They go, dude, I saw you doing this and I saw your book and you made the right decision. And, you know, Dixon Golf, no offense to those boys, Dixon Golf kind of flatlined when I left. The marketing genius went away. The spice went away. And because where I go, my marketing attention goes. And so I love it. I'm obsessed with it. I've got, you know, Dixon Golf Ball sitting right here on my floor, signed by Samuel Jackson and Don Cheadle and, you know, all these cool people that we got to hang out with. Even Kenny G was one of our ambassadors as well.
He's got the saxophone.
Oh, dude, it was so cool. And I just had a lot of fun doing it, but it came down to sales and marketing. And I also realized, like, wherever I put sales and marketing, my attention, my brain, my sales and marketing brain on whatever product I have, it's going to blow up, whether it's golf or something else. And it took somebody else to tell me that. It took Jeff Dumas to be like, hey, dude, like, no offense, but you're putting a lot of time and attention reinventing the way things are done. This eco-friendly thing is really, really cool, but is it making you money? I was like, no. He's like, how many golf balls do you have to sell so Pace takes home 30 grand a month?
Was she the one that was kind of like, hey, you're really cool and nice and all, that's nice that you're kind of having your fun thing with the Avengers, but could you like bring home some money so we can like start building a future together?
She never said anything because she was at the time she was 24 and I was like 26, and so she didn't know what she knows now, which now she's 36 and I'm 40. At the time she was just happy to have I'm really lucky. She came into my life and she had a 1-year-old son, and she felt like nobody would ever want to date her because she had this 1-year-old son, right? She had this like thing. So I think I got really lucky that she was just like, I'm just grateful to have a guy that has any sort of job and actually pays attention to my son and cares about my son. And so I think I had a grace period to figure it out for like 2 years before she caught on that I didn't have any money. And so she never said anything to me, but I figured it out on my own. And next thing you know, she started representing me on my flips and started getting involved in my real estate stuff. And she got her license and we started dominating together and had a lot of fun.
Is she part of the Keegley team then?
Laura's not part of the Keegley team. Okay. Neither am I. I'm not part of Keegley either.
Well, for some reason, I thought she was doing real estate under that flag.
I think the reason people believe that is because the TV show on A&E, Triple Digit Flip, she is the real estate agent for all of our flips.
Got it. That,
but in real life, she's not. She doesn't represent Jamil. Jamil and me and Rahima don't actually partner in flips in real life.
Mm-hmm. Laura, I remember Jamil telling us that.
Yeah, it's just like it's all a fictitious thing. And A&E won't listen to this podcast. I've been on big podcasts that they don't listen to, so I feel safe. Like I can say whatever I want.
This is you're in the bubble here.
Yeah. I'm in the bubble, which is good. Trust. I mean, I was saying stuff on Grant Cardone's. It was so funny. I was on Grant Cardone's podcast and him and I are sitting there talking very candidly about how TV is so bull crap. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, okay, they haven't started the podcast yet. So we're recording. We're like talking. I'm just smashing on A&E for 20 straight minutes. And then he goes, all right, let's start the podcast. I'm like, all right, cool. Podcast comes out a month later and I click on it and it's the first 20 minutes is the warm-up of me just bashing the TV show.
That's rough.
And I'm like, I'm going to get a call from A&E. A&E never, nobody even, they don't care. They don't care. Anyway, so I feel safe saying this. When they came to us, they DM me on Instagram. Okay. They saw my YouTube channel. They were like, wow, we're really impressed. We want to do a TV show with you. And I sent them a DM back, voice memo. I was like, you're full of crap. TV's crap. You guys are full of it. Blah, blah, blah. Leave me alone. And then I was like, don't bother me. I've had a lot of friends that just say, you guys are just full of BS. I don't have anything to do with this. And she came back very polite, very professional. And she says, well, what about us do you think is crap? I go, nothing on your TV shows is real. I watch those TV shows. It's like, where's the closing costs associated? Where's the holding costs? Like people are getting hard money on these houses and you guys aren't accounting for that. Are these people just flush with cash? Like you, and then these construction costs, are you joking me? Mm-hmm. Like if I go into a budget of $30,000 on a fix and flip, I walk out of that project spending $62,000. Like it doubles. Everything doubles. Price doubles. Timeline doubles. Yep. Every time.
Don't rub it in.
Well, that's what happens on flips. And so I'm like, you guys are crap. And they go, well, what if we give you creative control? I'm like, what does that look like? So they sucked us into this world of like, the narrative is up to you. You can say what you want. Tell the real numbers, blah, 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 blah. Guys, they were not lying.
Really? So you don't feel like it got whitewashed out? Even
no, no. This is where I'm leading. They let me say whatever I wanted on set. They recorded everything I said, but when it went to the chopping thing, they cut out nine. Literally, this is the most interesting thing ever. For every 45 minutes of TV, they have to film roughly 80 hours of content. So if you go back and you watch the TV show, which I don't suggest anybody go do, right? But you watch
clapping in the background.
Yeah. Any TV show that you watch about fixing and flipping, watch how quick they go through scenes. It's like you went from here to here to here to here to here to here. Each one of those scenes took 4 hours to film, and they got 15 seconds out of that. And so the people who are the real magic in TV are the editors, because they're the ones that are pulling out the snippets and creating a narrative and a story that you're like, I did not say it that way. Mm-hmm. And they're like, well, it is you and you did say it. I'm like, but you stitched two completely non-related things together to tell a story. I'm like, so dude, it's crap. And so...
Hey, okay. This is what I really want to know. So you are, let's say you're a TV star. You have a YouTube channel that has, what do you have, 8 million followers? Is that what you dug up, Ted?
I think total across all our platforms, we have millions of followers. But my YouTube channel, we get 5 million views a month, which is I'm really proud of.
That is awesome. But what now, I would assume you got to like, and I know you're not doing this for that, but like, how much money are you making off of your media channels that you have between YouTube and the book and the show and all the stuff that you do to, you know, travel around the country?
Okay. So it's just a different lead mechanism, right? So like other people, I used to have a big door knocking team back in 2018, 2019 before COVID hit and kind of destroyed our thought process behind door knocking. We thought, oh crap, we can't door knock anymore because of COVID. We should have just kept door knocking, but we put it on pause. It was really hard for us. It was hard psychologically for us to restart that back up. I would have kept the door knocking team going if we didn't shut it down. But I also today would never go start a door knocking team because we've passed that phase of our business, if that makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, would you buy a laundromat when you're brand new in business because it's so simple, you have one employee? Yes. But at my point in my phase of business, would I look at buying a laundromat? It's like, no, because there's such a cap in your ability to make a lot of money there. Like, I got to go put my time and attention to something that's going to make a lot more money, right? I'm in a different phase. So the reason I bring that up is like getting deals at one point, a big phase of my life was knocking doors, cold calling, sending direct mail, doing all that kind of stuff. But because I have a different lead mechanism, which is my social media, last year we acquired $100 million in real estate just from my audience / community, $100 million. Okay. I teach you how to go do something. You go do it. You're going to bring it back to me because you have a question and you're not quite sure, because there's no way on YouTube that I can teach you everything. It's impossible. It's like every deal has its own nuance, right? Every seller has their own problem. Everything has its own issue. And there's no way that and I'm crazy on YouTube. I'm not like other people. I don't do 12-minute videos. I do 45-minute videos, an hour-long video. I'm like very nitty-gritty. And even with that, people have thousands of questions. And so they come back to me and I go, sell the deal to me and I'll help you clean up your problem. Right. And that's now our new lead gen. Like, I got rid of door knocking. I got rid of a lot of things because that's my new lead gen. And so like right now I just got an email from Bo. He's my underwriter for my team. Bo, I told Bo, hey, I want to go buy this deal from a buddy of mine, Tim, because I need $30 million in real estate before the end of the year, or else I'm going to pay taxes. And he sends me this email. He says, Pace, don't buy that deal from Tim. In our pipeline right now, we have $19 million that's looking to close in the next 60 days. And I'm like, what? Why didn't I know about that $19 million? He's like, well, it's come from social media. It's come from your audience. People are bringing deals to us and we're doing a lot of deals. So I make a significant amount of money from my social media. And it's just because it's a different lead source. I also think about this. You want to go raise money for a big multifamily deal? You got to have a brand, right? Because you got people like, you have to. You're competing against a guy like me that's doing so many things. I've got a free Facebook group with 120,000 members. I've got a YouTube channel that gets 5 million views a month. I've got a Wall Street Journal bestselling book. I'm on TV. I've got Instagram that, you know, just in the last 30 days, we got 30,000 followers on Instagram. I've got TikTok. I've got LinkedIn. I'm on stages. I'm traveling around the world. I'm shaking hands with people. If you're competing with me to raise money from the same audience, who's going to win? Me.
The guy that takes 5,000 pictures with people a month.
There you go. And the person that's going out there and doing the thing that nobody wants to do. I'm essentially knocking 10,000 doors in Korea, but I'm doing it in now my real estate world, right? I'm doing the same thing. That hard work nobody wants to do. I'm having to work out in my hotel rooms. I'm sleeping a lot of times on my own. I'm doing the stuff that nobody wants to do. And all of that is just a tributary to the main flow, which is the main flow is buying real estate. So last year, for example, I go, all right, we currently own about $350 million in real estate at this time. And I would say that 200 million of that 350 is mine, right? Because I've got partnerships and I've got people involved in these deals. So, you know, out of 350 million, about $200 million worth of ownership is mine. All right, well, let's go big. I want to be a billionaire. That's what the conversation was back with my partner, Josiah, back in like October of last year. And he's like, really? You want to be a billionaire? I go, no, I want to be somebody worthy of receiving $1 billion. And as of right now, I don't have $1 billion. That means I'm not worthy of it. I haven't worked on my leadership. I haven't worked on my communication skills. I haven't worked on my network enough. I haven't acquired enough assets. I have not done enough to be worthy of $1 billion. And I want to have that life path. I want to have the life path that it requires such tremendous growth in order for me to become that person that I'm worthy of it. So I found, you know, talking to Grant, who's become a good friend, he's like, the only way you're hitting $1 billion in real estate, or I'm sorry, net worth, is to have $10 billion in real estate, because you'll end up, you know, with partners and this, that, and the other, and debt that you have on it. You'll end up having about 10% of that as your equity portion. So you want to be a billionaire? You got to go buy $10 billion in real estate. I go, all right, how am I going to do that? And I said, all right, I'm going to go raise capital. I'm going to go put a fund together. Mm-hmm. So we put a fund together. It's called the Sub2 Fund. And we just closed our first deal yesterday, 160 units, seller finance, Tucson. Thank you. And I raised money for that. So now how do I raise money? I raise money through my podcast. I raise money through my book. I raise money through Goodwill and free Facebook groups and giving and giving and giving and giving and giving to the point where the law of reciprocity takes over and people will invest in me just because they go, I freaking owe you, dude. Like, you've done so much to change my mindset and the trajectory of my family. You've done so much to help my wife with all your, you know, transaction coordination training. You've done all these things that have helped my family in so many different ways. Here's a check for $150,000. I don't get people to invest in my fund without the social media. It doesn't happen.
Hey, Pace, I want to highlight something here that you're talking about. So I had this conversation when Ted and Denlis, our producer, who you can't see here, but he's lurking back there in the background, the creepy voice. Mm-hmm. We had this conversation early on where I had, and as a lot of people do, you know, a little bit of imposter syndrome, and I wasn't comfortable in front of a camera, and just, you know, the whole aspect of putting yourself out there was a little bit intimidating, even though I felt like I knew my stuff enough to where I could talk about it. My whole jam always had been one-on-one meetings or small group meetings with people where I could share ideas and that'd be the kind of the way that I would mentor, quote unquote. And Denlis came along and said, you are doing yourself and a lot of other people a disservice by not putting your content out there so that they have the opportunity to learn from you or be in your sphere. And that's bullshit, basically, is what Denlis told me in not so many words with a Jamaican accent. He basically challenged me and said, you need to start doing this because you're limited by your ability to get in front of someone one-on-one.
Yeah,
One meeting with one person. And if you put that same amount of time into recording what you just had and put it out there and you do a good job with it, you have an exponential opportunity to, like, you know, touch people all around the world for what you're looking to do. And here's one thing that just happened to me. And so I'm still not really like comfortable doing it, right? I'm still in that kind of like sophomore stage of like putting content together and putting it out there. I created a reel about 2 weeks ago, and it was basically how a homeowner can sell a property themselves as is without using an agent. Because that is a conversation. I mean, how many thousands of times have you probably heard that same conversation or participated?
Yeah, how many agents did you have hating on you in the comments? Yeah.
Right. Well, so I put this out there and it got, you know, like I'm not a big, I don't have a big following, but it got a few thousand hits on it. And I got some comments and, you know, some feedback and whatever. And then 2 weeks later, so this just happened, my business partner and I that flip houses together, we got a lead in from my Instagram reel, and we're closing on this next Friday.
Yeah,
and
there you go.
It's going to be about a $50,000 profit deal.
Yeah.
And I was and Brandon is kind of like definitely imposter syndrome because he like gives me shit all the time about, you know, creating content and whatever. Like, ooh,
of course,
are you filming today or whatever? How's the podcast? And I'm like, you can no longer give me crap about creating this stuff because you're putting 25K in your own pocket because of a reel that I created. So I'm just saying I'm a believer in it. Am I comfortable doing it? No, but I will still do it because I can see what this does for not just me and my businesses, but for everyone else that has an interest in this and wants to learn and wants to be involved, but they don't know how to go about doing it.
This is the way I switched my mindset around it. Okay. A couple of different things. Cause I was the same way. I didn't start my YouTube channel until 3 years ago. And even after I started my YouTube channel, I took like 9 months off because I wasn't willing to invest in it. I was just like, oh, I'll figure it out. I'll do the editing myself. I just had a limited mindset around just hire the people and spend the money. Right. My media team now, okay, just my media team every month, the payroll is 90 grand a month.
Oh, okay.
The payroll. So I'm telling you how far my brand has changed. My mindset changed 90 grand a month. So you're like, where does that money come from? Oh my gosh, we could talk about this for hours. Okay. I even had one of my good buddies who gets, you know, he has 600,000 subscribers on YouTube. He's like, hey, I'm thinking about hiring a blah, blah, blah for my media team. I'm like, bro, I have three of those. Hurry the freak up. Like, what are you waiting for? And his question was, well, where does the money come from? And I broke it down. I told him where the money came from. And he's like, who taught you this? I go, I had to go through trial and error. He's like, where did this start? Well, this is where it started for me. Two main things changed my mind. Number one, I looked at the people I wanted to be like and make the similar money to. And I said, are they people that have self-esteem issues? Because that's really what the lack of confidence is. And like imposter syndrome is like your self-esteem. It's like, one, am I open to people talking shit? Because you're going to get that, especially no offense to real estate agents. That's like job number one of being a real estate agent is just hate on other real estate agents and then follow up with that. Hate everybody that doesn't like real estate agents. That's what you just do as an agent. And so I have a license as an agent thinks. I have a license to now criticize everybody else. That's like how I feel about agents. So you have to be open to just getting people talk crap about you. And so I started watching videos of other people. I typed into YouTube. I was like, how to deal with haters. Oh my gosh. I saw Grant Cardone did this video about 4 years ago and he did this equation. He broke down what a hater is and who they are and all that kind of stuff. And he's like, let me list out the top 25 people I communicate with on a daily basis. Not one of these people is a hater. These are people that are constantly trying to level up. He's like, so why would I care what any hater says? He's like, I let them make all the comments. I don't block them because all they do is help the algorithm. And they don't even realize that their hateful comments are actually helping me. And I'm like, okay, all right, cool. I can get over this mindset. And he also was like, you will never meet somebody that you want to be like that will talk down on other people. And I'm like, okay, cool. I like this. I like this. I like this. All right. So that was a big one. It was like talking about the self-esteem. Do these people I want to be like, do they have self-esteem issues? Okay, they don't. If they don't have self-esteem issues, then one of the steps I have to take is get rid of my self-esteem issues.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least be aware that I have them and do it anyway. Right? It's like the boo-boos on the playing field, right? It's like, got it. You scuffed your knee. Get your ass up and get out on the playing field. Like, we got it. You got hurt. Shut up, you know? So that was number one. Now, number two, this is the most significant mind paradigm that I had. This came from my own watching other people. People would come to me and go, man, you are winning. This is before my YouTube channel. Okay. They said, dude, you are winning. You are winning in a big way. Like people are sending you deals. You're doing this, this, and this. You're getting all this opportunity. What are you doing? And I don't know why this came to my mind, But I thought about Michael Keaton. Do you guys remember the movie Multiplicity?
Oh, yeah.
Pizza. She touched my peppy, Steve.
Pizza, Steve.
Yeah. That movie came to my mind. And I was like, the reason I'm winning is because I create clones to carry on my workload. And then I was like, wow, that was a really smart statement. It just came out of nowhere. And then I told the same person, I go, when I look at my phone, I don't look at my phone as a phone. I don't look at a camera as a camera. I look at both of those as a clone creation device. And if I want to carry on a message to somebody and I don't want to have my throat hoarse and coarse from talking about the same question 1,000 times, then why don't I just get really good at answering the question, record a clone answering that question, and then send that clone out into the world to do my bidding for the rest of my life in perpetuity? That is how I scale. And so now when you look at my YouTube channel, let me pull up my YouTube channel. I'll give you the exact number. This is my measurement of success in my entire life. Okay. Everything in my life professionally comes down to this one measurement. So check this out. I will pull it. I won't screen share, but I'll tell it to you. In the last 28 days, I'm looking at the numbers right now. Last 28 days, my YouTube channel has had people watch it for 168,000 hours. So what do you think? Nighttime, weekends, evenings, mornings, afternoons, there are thousands of people watching my YouTube clones. They're not watching me. They're watching a clone I created 2 years ago, a year ago, a week ago, whatever it is, to do my bidding. And so what I do now is I'm very intentional about what my clones are saying, because those clones won't die. They will continually say the same thing over and over and over. Good example of this. I had this challenge I did like a year ago. And I said, hey guys, and it was on a YouTube video. I go, hey guys, if you want to join the challenge, go over to my Instagram and type in the word challenge. Okay, well, that challenge was over a year ago. Guess what happens? Every day I get 13, 14 people come into my Instagram DMs and type in the word challenge. And I have to tell my team, hey, just tell them that that thing was over a long time ago. Think about that. I have 13 people a day taking action on something I created a year ago. That is a clone that does that work for me, not me.
Well, and I mean, Travis Banks is a great example of this too. He, you know, he was taking your content, watching, you know, he's become a clone.
Yes.
From the content you put out there. And now he is the guy that's wearing the peace hat. He is he's speaking at every one of our RIA events on the mic, name dropping you, putting the guy's extremely intelligent. He's getting your deals done. I mean, heck, he's going to be our featured speaker in November, just preaching the Morby way.
You know? And that's the thing, is I teach my community how to go out and create their own clones too. I have a whole entire like portion of my education that teaches only how to go create clones the way I create clones. And so Travis is going out and creating those clones. So I even tell people, I go, don't step on stage unless somebody's recording you. Because what you've just done is you had this opportunity to create a clone of yourself talking about whatever the topic is. That's a whole entire clone going out and doing whatever. So be intentional. What are you looking for? And this is something that was really interesting. Like, what do you really want? And I had to think about this. What do I want in my life? Here's what I want. I want to recruit quality people for my companies. I want to recruit quality opportunities to my world. Okay. And three, I want to buy a lot more real estate. That's what I want. So every single YouTube video, every Instagram I do has the subtle nuance of calling out those three things, because I know that whatever I speak about, my clones will speak about for forever. And I have to have a call to action that even somebody watching that in a year from now is like, oh my gosh, hey, are you still hiring for this position? No, we're not, but we're hiring for these three positions. That is now an automated world behind the scenes. So the people that are not doing content, right? The people that are making fun of you for not doing content, I look at them and I'm like, you're like a teenager that is 16 years old that has the ability to get your driver's license, but you're sitting there making fun of me that I got mine.
Yep. That's a good way to put it. So Pace, we haven't really talked much about, you know, your whole, you're kind of the guy right now that's known as the creative finance guy or the sub two guy, right? That's your brand. So I had this, we were talking before you came on. Do you ever get sick of that? Like the creative finance label where like you have people following you into McDonald's to see if you try and negotiate a creative finance deal on a Happy Meal?
Oh yeah. It's fun. I'm so grateful. I'm grateful for it. I think that I found my lane. Before I was the creative finance guy, I was the mobile home guy. Before I was the mobile home guy, I was the assisted living guy. Like I've done all the things that you can imagine, and I found the vein that I was absolutely obsessed with, and I stayed in that lane and expanded it. And the cool thing about creative finance is that it's so diverse, and it's not like, hey, well, I'm doing the Burr deal. Like, it's like, how much could I talk about the Burr deal, a Burr strategy? Very, you could talk about it, but like after 6 months of talking about it, it's over. It's like, guy, hey, Pace, we heard enough. With creative finance, I buy businesses with creative finance. I buy cars with creative finance. I got a student that bought 3 airplanes with creative finance. We buy everything real estate with creative finance. Creative finance is the fuel that you can pour on any other strategy. And so it's something that I can't get sick of it because I can't touch all the topics physically that I could cover with creative finance. It is so diverse and the strategies are so endless. It's like sub-2, seller finance, hybrids, novation agreements, Morby methods, Gator, lease options, wraps, so many freaking strategies, dating contracts, all sorts of things, executory contracts. I could talk about executory contracts for 3 years before I get sick of those. And so there's so many more strategies to buy real estate and even buy businesses than there are with cash. It's like cash. All right, cool. I would definitely get sick of cash, but I don't physically see how I could get sick of creative stuff.
Well, that's one thing that's good about your content too, is you always have something creative to talk about. It can always be a different topic. I probably consume about 15 hours of your podcast in the last 7 days.
Oh, yeah.
And just to kind of prepare myself. And I remember I was listening to one and you were talking about, hey, my cameraman didn't understand exactly what we were talking about here. So I asked him what equipment he wanted. Here I am, you know, repeating the content you put out there. But, you know, cameraman is like, hey, this is what I want. You said you got on Facebook Marketplace. You found exactly what you wanted. 3 calls later, you worked out a deal to make payments on it. And I mean, that was interesting to listen to. And for people that can't understand real estate, that's just a whole nother way to put their perspective in there.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm speaking on the Bigger Pockets conference stage here next month.
We'll be there.
Dude, they are so bureaucratic. It's ridiculous.
We saw you last year. You were up talking. And Ted and I were both in there. I think you were in there too, Denless. And
you took over the whole entire panel.
We're like, oh God, he needs to be like the featured guy.
Yeah. Okay. Do you know why I did that? I'm going to be really honest. You know why I did that? I did not plan on doing that. They put people on my panel that have never done a creative finance deal in their life.
Oh, we actually brought that up.
Yeah, we saw it.
We're like, what?
So I'm sitting there. This is what happened. So they go, hey, Pace, we're going to have you on a panel. This is before I wrote a book with them and we built a really strong relationship where I could actually share my opinion with them. But what they did is they're like, okay, this creative finance thing seems to be getting pretty popular. Let's throw this creative finance guy on there. And you know what? We don't know anybody else that's dominating creative finance. So instead of asking Pace, who obviously knows, let's go to our sponsors and ask our sponsors, would you like to be featured on stage again because you sponsored the event? Mm-hmm. So it was, they put people on the stage that literally had no idea about creative finance. Like I love Matt Faircloth. I love him.
We're just talking about him right before you got on. Yep.
But he's not a creative finance guy. Why did you put him on my panel? Okay. He's never done a creative finance deal. Why is he on my panel? And then you put a hard money lender on my creative finance panel. That is anything but creative. Like okay. That is the Burr strategy. Get those people off. So luckily I was able to have Scott Horn, who's my attorney in Texas. He does a lot of my creative finance deals in Texas. I was able to bring one person on because I saw the panel. I was like, I love Matt Faircloth, but I don't understand why he's on there. I like this hard money lender guy. He seems cool, but he's not a hard money lender, they're not creative. That's the cash world. And I do cash deals too, but I'm going to sit here and people are going to ask questions from the audience. What about this? And I got to defer to people that have never done a creative. Hell no, that's not happening. And so what happened is, if you guys go back to the footage, you'll see, I ask a question. The audience member asks a question. I go to everybody on the panel and 3 of the 5 guys couldn't answer the question. So I had to skirt past them. And the second question comes up and the only person that could answer the question was me and Scott. So that's the second question. I go, you know what? I'm standing up. I'm not going to waste an hour of 1,000 people's time. And I just decided I'm taking this over. I'm going to leave you guys with something of value. And there was a lot of people in that audience that were like, thank you so much for doing that, because it was going in the wrong direction. I did get a lot of hate for it. I got people like, you just stood up and turned into a douchebag. I'm like,
no, you did what we wanted to hear. And the whole reason we're there.
Put yourself in that same situation. You're the, and why would you put the creative finance guy as the moderator?
We had thought that was really odd. Well, the whole setup,
the whole fail of BP was not to have, I mean, he'd say, but BP didn't have a great keynote. Like Hal Elrod the year prior was amazing to listen to. Like, yes. It stuck with me to this time. And the whole time I'm there, I'm like, tell me why Pace is not the keynote speaker of the event.
Like, why? But even if I'm not the keynote, why not make me and one, like, call me and go, hey, Pace, if we were going to have a creative finance panel, there's nobody in the industry that can touch me on creative finance. Nobody. There's people that do like one or two deals a year on creative finance. That's all I do is creative finance. I don't even touch cash, really. Maybe 5% of my deals are cash. 95% of my, I've created the greatest community on planet Earth that are doing thousands of creative finance deals every single month. We've changed the way that title companies and closing attorneys do business based on how I teach. And you want me as the moderator? No. You call me and you say, hey, Pace, we'd like to have you. I say, oh my gosh, what an honor. Thank you so much. Pace, who else would you like to have on the panel with you that would actually make this such a powerful panel? And I would have said, let's have a closing attorney come on from a closing attorney state, and let's have a escrow agent who does this as well. And let's have a licensed agent who does deals with me as the panel, and have a moderator that doesn't know anything about creative finance so that they can authentically and genuinely go, I actually don't know the answer to this. Who can answer this question? But you gave the guy who had all the answers the microphone, and you asked me to have other people that have never done a creative. That doesn't make an iota of sense until you understood that the people they put on the panel were people that paid as sponsors, and they were looking for a place to put those sponsors instead of just saying, hey, you don't get a spot.
Yeah. Well, I mean, well said on that. I think one thing that you, and I'm sure you've heard this before, but one thing that I found that really effective, like great speakers are able to do, is break down complicated things to a third grade level so that everybody in the audience has no questions about like what that means. And you make a lot of comparisons to things that people understand.
But this is what I get. This is the bureaucratic part. The tangent I just went on was meant to tell you that even this year for BPCon, I have my own room. I have an hour and a half.
Nice.
And I give them my presentation. I go, this is what I want. They go, hey, we want to talk about how to get your first deal or your second deal with creative finance. That's the topic. I go, all right, easy. So I go through, I create my slides, and they came back and they start telling me, we don't like that you have stories in here. You need to be more tactical.
I want stories.
We are cavemen. We have to learn through stories. And you're telling me I can't use my grocery analogy. I can't use this analogy. I can't use this. They basically stripped the storytelling out of my presentation.
Which is your whole, that's what makes you so effective.
Who you are.
Yeah.
I mean, if I think about
I can't stories, learn I mean, without a story.
I don't. Funnies, whatever.
Here's the other thing too, is if you're a speaker and you can't pull a rando out of the audience and go, hey, who doesn't understand what I'm talking about? And somebody goes, slowly, me, they raise their hand, they go, me. If you can't take that person out and tell a story about them as an individual, then you don't deserve a space on stage. And this is what I know I'm aggressive about this, but like there's a lady, this was a couple of months ago. I was speaking at Tariq El Moussa's event, and I was, you know, you look through the audience, you look at people's eyes. Are people getting this? Okay, great. Move on. Da 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 da. Boom, 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 boom. Story, story, story. You see the people go, you know, you see all that stuff and you move on. Had a lady that was like, her eyes were kind of glossing over, and I go, what's your name? My name's Sue. Sue, what do you do for a living? She says, oh, I'm an elementary teacher. So all of a sudden I pivot. And I start telling analogies about school teachers and how this relates to creative finance. And she starts crying. And she says, I've done so many books and watched so many videos. It wasn't until you could talk to me as a school teacher that I could understand this. That is what a good speaker does. Yep. is can break down as an individual. And I'll ask people when I'm speaking on stage with for them, I'll go, who's your audience? What's their demographic? And they go, I don't know why that's important. They're people that want to learn real estate. I'm like, no. But like, what's their age group? Are they primarily female, male? Are they mothers? Are they people? Like if I go talk to Carlos Reyes's audience, it's a very different demographic than if I go talk to Tarik El Moussa's audience. Tarik El Moussa's audience are like married with children in their retirement 8 years. If I go talk to Carlos Reyes's group, it's like young minorities that don't want to have kids until they become millionaires. So the stories I'm going to tell are so polar opposite that this is why people want me to speak on stages, because I identify who I'm speaking to and I change the story to do that. So when I talk about BP, they're like, we just want you to go through the slides. I'm like, you want a speaker to just go through the slides? Oh. And one of the girls that I was talking to, she says, well, it's because I'm a visual learner. And so I like looking at slides and taking notes. And I'm like, then don't have me speak. Cause I'm not going to read through my slides. Have you guys ever seen somebody speak where you're like, I'm really glad they had these slides up here so I could take notes.
Right.
Yeah. I don't even really care. Like, so no, they, I'm a speaker. Our
make
best.
Me feel something.
Yeah.
Get me to understand one concept. Get me to walk away understanding one more thing that I understood an hour ago, and you've done your job. And so, yes, I talk about a lot of things, but my main thing is I tell two or three stories in the very beginning based on the audience to get them to understand what creative finance is first before I go into teaching what creative finance can do for you. And so I have this really fun thing that I do. Which I planned on doing for BP, but they're not letting me do it. It's so simple. I go down into the audience. I go, who has an iPhone? Who has a phone that they would sell me? And you get like 15 people that raise their hand. I go, all right, keep your hands raised. Do you own your phone free and clear? And they go, yeah, I own it free and clear. I go, okay, perfect. I go to the next person. I go, do you have a payment plan? I need somebody that has a payment plan. Out of the other 14 people, who has a payment plan on their phone that they still are making monthly payments? And somebody always says, yeah, I'm still making payments to AT&T for the phone, right? I'm on a payment plan. I go, perfect. Both of you guys come up to the stage. So I go, how much? They come up to the stage. I go, how much is your phone? How much would you sell your phone to me for, the first person? They go, well, I don't know. It's probably worth $600. I go, great. Would you sell that phone to me for $700 if you would give me the ability to make payments? I'll pay you $700 instead of $600, what it's worth. And the person's like, yeah, I probably would. All right, cool. Let's do $100 payments for 7 months. At the end of 7 months, I owe nothing. They go, great. Okay, cool. That's called seller finance, guys. That's the seller. They're financing the phone to me. I'm making monthly payments to them. Does everybody understand? The audience magnificently all of a sudden knows what seller finance is. The
light bulb goes on.
Light bulb goes off. Then I go to the person that has a payment plan on it and I go, you have a payment plan. How much is your payment plan? Oh, it's like, you know, $42 a month. Perfect. I'll take over the $42 payment plus give you $58 a month if you sell that to me for $700. And they go, okay, great. I go, I just bought their property subject to with a portion of seller finance. And the audience goes, and it actually makes sense.
Yep.
Why would you not want me to do that?
Just do it.
Yeah.
I'm going to.
Screw them.
It might be the last time BP ever has me speak.
No, you got too big of a following. You're too big of a name. They're going to keep on bringing you back. But you just be you.
That's the thing a lot of people, you got to understand, is that the reason people have had a hard time with creative finance in the past is because you get these people that are overly complicated. Like, I love Ron LeGrand, OG badass in the creative finance realm. I'm friends with him. I respect him. He's amazing. But the reason why he never changed the game of creative finance is because he never told stories that the everyman could understand.
Yeah.
And if you can't get an agent to understand what creative finance is and how it benefits their seller, then you're never going to get a deal done. Because creative finance is that thing that's like, I don't know what that is. Therefore, it must be illegal. Mm-hmm. So if you can't overcome those objections with storytelling, you can't just tell. I did a really good example of this the other day. Oh my gosh. I get a broker. I'm working on an 8-plex the other day. I very rarely get on the phone. I have a team that does all that stuff now. Part sad, but part, you know, you got to scale your business. You got to not be involved, right? Santa Claus doesn't make the toys. So, which I came up with that phrase like 2 years ago. That is one of the things that like reminds me to continue to scale and stop being involved in everything is like, does Santa make the toys and deliver them? No. Like somebody else makes the toys, right?
Everybody knows.
I'm on the phone. with this broker and I go, you know what? I'm going to turn this into a really poor way to explain creative finance to a broker. So when a broker says it's illegal, the poor response is, no, you're wrong. I've done it so many times. You're wrong. I can show you proof that in the state statutes, it says this, 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 and this, and my closing attorney will show you that you're wrong. Okay, that's one way of doing it. But what does Dale Carnegie say in How to Win Friends and Influence People? A man convinced against his will is of the same opinion still. So just because I choke you and tell you that you're wrong and I prove everything to you doesn't mean as a human being you're going to walk away from that conversation ecstatic and happy that we had it. You're going to walk away saying, that guy's an asshole. But if I say, oh, yeah, I totally get why you think that. Let me tell you a story about blah, 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 and how it benefited my last seller and da, 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 da. And maybe this helps your seller, maybe it doesn't, but I just want to be an offer sitting in the back of your pocket just in case you need to come back to me. Can I tell you a couple of stories of how it's benefited my other sellers? And when you do that, even if you hear no, the door's open, not only on that deal that maybe they still can't sell the deal, they come back to you, or B, that agent runs into a different deal later down the road and goes, oh my gosh, that Pace guy, he was so nice. He told me a story that actually resonated with me. And so I have these two examples. One, I made a broker cry on this Zoom 2 weeks ago. It's so bad that I'm like, I can't release that on YouTube. It's so bad. The other one is just me talking to another broker the same day, telling them stories. I never even brought up the word subject to seller finance novation agreement. I brought up stories of, well, you know, one way we can get this deal done is we can actually partner with the seller. And what that looks like is blah, da, da, blah, da, 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 story, 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 how it benefited another seller, third party anecdotes. Boom. Broker has light bulb moments, goes, oh my gosh, I actually thought I understood this, but now that you told me that story, I see how my client could be benefited. Give me a couple of days, I'll get back to you. So the only way to talk about creative finance to a seller, a broker, a prospect, or even somebody you're maybe raising money from, a private money lender, is learn basic anecdotal stories like the F-150 story, which I tell all the time, the bunny story, which I tell all the time. These stories get people to go, holy crap, I finally understand it. The iPhone analogy, do you have a payment or do you own it free and clear? People go, I don't understand the difference between subject to and seller finance. Okay, well, let me tell you not about a house and a note and deed of trust and a mortgage and a this, that, and the other. People don't understand that crap, but they understand the iPhone thing. So it's, you know, from the reason I think we're winning in the creative finance realm is predominantly because of my ability to tell a story.
Well, Pace, this has been awesome. We know you've got to get going here. We have one last section.
We're almost out of time. Let's get into the OT with Owen and Ted. You're listening to the OT with Owen and Ted, sponsored by JM Real Estate Capital.
Hi, it's Rob, JM Real Estate Capital. We're the money guys that you need to know for all your real estate investments. Talk to us. We can do what your local bank can't or won't do. We don't have millions. We have trillions with a T to lend. 844-WE-CLOSE or go online, jmrecapital.com. That's jmrecapital.com. JM Real Estate Capital, smart solutions for the real estate investor.
And we've got the same questions we ask every guest. The first one, these are kind of deep, all right? So you got to be on your toes on this. All right, okay. Here we go. This actually is a softball for you. So here's what we normally ask people. What will your first book be titled or about since you are fresh off publishing your new book? Mm-hmm. What's it called?
Wealth Without Cash. I really want it to be called the Creative Finance Bible. I want it, you know how like the Bible is a collection of books? Mm-hmm. I wanted to do a book just about sub two, seller finance, novation agreements, lease option, all that stuff, and like compile it into like a gift box set type of thing. But Bigger Pockets is like, that will take too long. Let's just do one. So Wealth Without Cash, and it's a good book.
And more to come.
More to come, yeah.
Awesome. Okay, Ted, what do you got?
You got my sheet.
Oh, you have to go by memory. There you go.
Okay, Pace, you can interview anyone in the world today that's alive. Who would it be and what's one question you want to ask them?
Anyone in the world, I can ask them any question. What would it be? I had this exact scenario pop up just 4 months ago where I had the opportunity to actually ask the question to the one person I wanted to talk to. And so that whole satisfaction has been met. So let me tell you who that person was and what the question was, and I'll even give you the answer. I was able to spend a whole day with Tony Robbins, who's like, epic in a room of six people for 8 hours. So very intimate, amazing conversations. And my question, I was able, you know, we talked for a lot, but I was able to ask a very specific aimed question to him. And the question I had was, at some point in your life, you had to start saying no to things that were coming on your plate. I'm at a season in my life where I have so many opportunities and so many things coming to me. I have to start saying no to stuff, right? When do you say no? And what's the equation to saying no to things so that you don't either hurt feelings or maybe lose out on opportunity? And Tony Robbins' answer was, God did not put me on this earth to say no to opportunity. He put me on this earth to learn how to say yes to every opportunity. Because the reality is you are in the 1% of the 1% of the 1%, which means you have the ability to create jobs. And every time you turn an opportunity down, that means you've turned down the ability for 300 people to work for you, or 400 people to work for you, or 500 people to work for you. So what is the actual bottleneck of your problem is not that you don't want opportunity, it's that you can't physically handle them. I was like, yeah, that's actually true. Thank you. And he said, so tell me your corporate structure. Tell me how that works. And I got nitty gritty and I was like, I have five partners. They operate the back end. He goes, well, you need another operator. You need to say yes to every opportunity. He goes, you wouldn't be asking me this question if they were bad opportunities. You're asking me this question because they're good opportunities and you're having to say no to them, not because you don't have time. It's because you don't have the capability and you don't have the team to handle it. So build your team. And I go, wow, it's so simple, but it's so true. And he goes, here's the problem, Pace. At some point, you will realize, if you haven't already realized this now, you will only be able to take advice from less than one out of a million people in your life. You meet a million people. And because you're such a high performer, only one out of those 1 million people will be worthy of giving you advice. And he goes, you hang out with people that are not worthy of giving you advice. You spend time with people that are not worthy of giving you advice because they have not achieved what you want to achieve, and nor will they ever achieve what you desire. So you only need to be taking advice from people that are at a level that you achieve to be. And he goes, I think the greatest thing is that I could be the one answering this question, because all I'm doing right now is giving you permission to be who you are and only take advice from people you want to be.
Wow.
It was great. It was just like, be unapologetic. And it was great.
If I had a mic to drop right now, man.
Well, you do. It's right there. But please don't. It'll be loud.
Yeah.
It was good. It was very tactical too. Like, a lot of that was somewhat ambiguous. I mean, it's specific advice, but he also broke down my corporate structure in a 15-minute thing. And he's like, okay, you got to move that person over here and you need to get a person here. And here's how my 111 businesses are structured. And I got to see the inside underneath the hood of the car. And now it was magnificent.
I've never had a response that was that good. So thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good stuff. All right. So we are at your funeral. It's very sad. Jamil is over in the corner crying. Mm-hmm. Who is going to deliver your eulogy, and what do you hope they say about you?
My wife will deliver my eulogy, and she will say, this is, nobody I've ever met has given more than this man. I don't even want my name on my tombstone. I wanted to say go giver on my tombstone.
Ooh, that's good.
I'm pretty positive Jamil said that you will be given his eulogy, just so you know.
Mm. Yeah, I could see it. He's older than me, so there's a possibility he dies before me.
But he has lost weight, I've noticed, on social media lately. So he
65 pounds.
He wants to outlive you. I think that's, you're in dueling eulogies, I think, what's going on here.
I saw you doing
my wife, I will definitely die before my wife. I will have a heart attack from working so hard. And so for sure, she's giving my eulogy.
What mentor in your life has had the biggest impact on you and how they influenced your career or personal growth?
A lot of people. I'm really good at pulling specific things from people instead of everything from that person. You know, I have people that are not married with kids, which is typically the people I really want to learn from. And they give like really good specific things on marketing or specific things on whatever. But I would say the person recently that is like as close to the person I want to be in the future is Bobby Castro. You guys should have Bobby Castro on here. He's dynamic. He's phenomenal. Sold a business for $1.1 billion 4 years ago. And, not only is that impressive, but he's created an ecosphere where his children thrive inside of his organization. And he's gone off to acquire $750 million in multifamily without partners, without investors. And the guy is living not only a very wealthy life, but he's also very healthy. Him and his wife are passionate about each other, even 37 years into their marriage. He has achieved what I think everybody is thinking, that's the plateau. Like, that's the plateau I want to land on. Because we're all going through a plateau. Then we get comfortable for a little bit. Okay, I'm time for a rise. I feel like the very top of this multi-layered plateau we're trying to get to is where Bobby Castro is. Like, he has it all. And 90% of it is all family, giving, changing people's lives, charity work. But he achieved it through doing amazing things in business. And so, but he never lost sight of, I'm doing this to make all this money to achieve this thing, not so I can have just nice things. And he truly is as grounded as I'm describing.
If you put a good word in for us, I'd love to reach out to him. So thank you.
Yeah, he's great.
Bobby Castro. Yeah, that's cool. I haven't heard
Bobby Castro. Sounds like one of the best people to follow.
Denlis, you got a question.
So I have a question, but I think I know the answer to it already. What did you want to be when you were younger? What did you want to be when you grew up?
I wanted to be a contractor because that's what I was told and taught to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought so. So let me just follow up on a quick one. Have you ever met Gary Vee?
I have met Gary Vee multiple times, yeah.
Oh, God, I'm so jealous.
Denlis is a fanboy.
The first time I met Gary Vee was probably 6 years ago. I paid $4,500 to go into a VIP section of a seminar so I could ask him a specific question. I literally paid $4,500 so I could ask him a question. And I ended up giving the question to Jamil instead of me because I was like, I don't know the question. I watched and consumed so much of his content. I think he's answered everything for me. And Jamil actually ended up asking him a question about a VC thing. And it was really impactful. Jamil was like, that was worth $100,000 to me. And then the second time I actually spoke on stage that he was at and we were in the green room together. Third time, same thing. Fourth time, same thing. And we run into each other a lot. And now like I'll see him at events. He comes up to me and gives me a hug. So like I'm at that point where I've seen him enough times that we are friendly, although we are not friends. Mm. And the reason we're not friends yet is because I don't feel like I have anything to offer him of value. And so I have not breached that line in the sand of like, we can't be friends until I can provide value to you. I don't want to be the guy that's only providing value one way. But when I become his friend, I'll invite you over to his house.
Oh, yeah. Let's go.
Oh, that's good, man. So last question for you, Pace. What are you excited about in your business right now? Is there anything that you're looking for that somebody catching this episode might be able to connect you with, whether it's people or things or deals or like what's on your radar right now?
Yeah, I mean, this is going to sound really cocky and maybe pretentious a little bit. And I'm okay with that because remember, I only get to live one life and I'm not going to care what anybody thinks about what I say. So I feel like I've won real estate. I've stood on the biggest stages of real estate. I have one of the most watched YouTube channels on real estate. I've got a TV show about real estate, a Wall Street Journal best-selling book about real estate. I have checked the boxes of real estate. I don't have to work ever again in my life because of how much I own in real estate. That's really cool. And so at some point you got to go, all right, well, I've achieved some amazing things. I don't want to stop achieving things in that arena, but I want to dabble into some other arenas. And so some of the arenas that I'm dabbling into is I'm starting a second YouTube channel where it is just me interviewing people that are recognizable family, like household names that I'm excited about talking to. Not that I'm trying to spread a message or I'm trying to, you know, promote a thing or whatever else. It is literally for me. It is only for me. And I'm going to go and do an interview a week with like the owner of Papa John's. And what was his rise look like? And what does his personal life look like now? How does he wish he raised his children differently? And really talk about life with these high achievers. And it is truly just a way for me to buy mentorship from these people I look up to. And that launches in January. The first person I get to interview is Mike Tyson. Next person.
Oh my God, that's cool.
Yeah, it's really cool. And then Jordan Peterson's on the list. Oh. Gary Vee's on the list. Yes. And it's not going to be about their business. It's going to be like, tell me about your personal life. Like what is currently going on in your life that you wish wasn't going on? What was a decision you made 5 years ago that now is a domino effect in your current life right now that you regret? Because we all do have regrets. I'm not saying you would go back and change it, but for the audience listening or even myself, what are the pitfalls that I can avoid on the path to ultimately become you know, at a get to a level that you're at. So I'm really excited about that. I would just say, look out for that, but I have nothing else. I have a lot of things I'm excited about. I have a lot of great partnerships. Honestly, like the thing that has made my life change are my partners, Josiah, Cody. Like I have 11 businesses and I have 5 partners that handle those 11 businesses, and they allow me to do the things that I need to do on a daily basis without going to any of our offices, interfacing with any of our employees. Like when I talk to our employees, it's like I come in and everybody gives me a hug and then I leave. Like that's my life at my company. And I'm so grateful for that, because then I can go create new things and build new relationships, and I can be on the road and I can create culture inside of our community, and I can do all the hard things that nobody else wants to do, but for some reason I want to do. And so I'm really excited about my partnerships. I wake up every morning wanting to thank them all, because they bring the polar opposite of what I have to the table.
One suggestion for Mike Tyson, I would ask him, like, I would want to know, what did Evander Holyfield's ears taste like?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I'm dead serious. I'm asking all these questions. Like one of my questions is, what's your favorite sex position? And like, I'm just going to ask questions I want to ask. Like, okay, he talked about this whole thing where he went through this phase, and I want to talk to him about this phase, the ear thing. Like I'm going to sit down and the opening line is, all right, Mike Tyson, we're all ears.
Oh, that's a great way to end it.
That's good. What's it called? Do you have a name yet?
It's going to be something with my name in it, like the Pace Show or Keeping Up with Pace or Keep Up the Pace or something along those lines, so that it's like, I need it to be obviously personally branded. I don't want, it's like Joe Rogan Show, right? What's smart about what Joe Rogan did is that, and I failed to do, my YouTube channel, my Instagram, my TikTok, all that stuff is personally branded, but my podcast is not. Mm-hmm. And so I'm glad it's not, to some, for some reasons and other reasons, I wish it was podcasted. It was named differently, and it was my name. Because what happens is when you interview people, people will share your interview with other people and they'll go, did you hear Joe Rogan interview Jordan Peterson? Versus, or they'll actually, what they say is they go, did you hear Jordan Peterson on the Joe Rogan Experience or on Joe Rogan's show? Right. But when you have like, here's a couple of good examples, like Wholesale Hotline, one of our podcasts gets 400,000 downloads a month. People reference it as Wholesale Hotline, not Pace, Jamil, and Brent, or something along those lines. And so I want it to be personally branded. So it'll be like keep up the pace, probably is what it is. And the opening line will basically be something like, all right, Mike, people look at you and they're like, I want to keep up the pace with Mike. I want to understand, how did you get to this level? I want to follow the same trajectory of wealth and this and that. What were the pitfalls? What was this? What do we have to watch out for? If I am tracking behind you and I'm trying to keep up the pace, what does that look like? What are my days look like? Right? What are the things that nobody knows about your daily routine that you struggle with? And those types of questions that are non real estate centric. Because I talk about real estate 7 YouTube videos a week, that I'm 7. Think about this. I'm 7 months ahead on my content. So for the next 7 months, I could literally go to Mars and come home and there will have been a YouTube video, a long form YouTube video posted every day for 7 days for 7 months straight. That's how much content we create. And so I don't need to go pour more into that machine, the real estate machine, the real estate branding machine. It's on autopilot to a certain degree. I now have extra time to go and do something that I'm excited about. So it'll be questions that are literally questions I'm curious about. Probably the everyday dude is going to be curious about.
Yeah, I thought we had a lot of content.
Yeah, I'm excited, man. That sounds like a lot of fun. It would be neat to be able to ask those kind of questions to famous people.
That'd be cool. And I'm going to do a live studio audience probably. I think I'm going to build a warehouse here soon in Tempe, Scottsdale, where people can actually come in and sit in the audience. And like, of course, I'll have a security person there, but I will have like Mike Tyson with 30 people in the studio audience. And I'll do my podcast. And then what I'll do is I'll shut it down and go, all right, we're going to do a live Q&A with Mike for 30 minutes. And what I'll do on my YouTube channel is I'll let people pay like $4 a month or something to get access to the private questions that the audience asked. so that like there's another element behind the scenes that nobody else gets to see. So I'm toying around with some of those fun ideas.
Well, let us know if we can get tickets to that show.
Yeah, of bonus content.
Yeah, we'll fly in. Hey, Pace, I want to just thank you full-heartedly for this. We couldn't ask for a better 100th episode podcast than to have you on
here. I saw that on the invite. I was like, holy crap, the 100th episode. This is, guys, I'm telling you, my podcast did not get traction until my 100th episode.
Well, we're
no kidding.
We're getting a lot of traction because of you, trust me. So we thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Of course, guys. Of course. I just keep going. I've got a podcast now that we're on like episode 300, and it's amazing that people will quit on their fifth podcast or their 10th podcast or whatever. I consider your 100th podcast as your first podcast because that's where the traction really starts coming in.
Yeah. That's why I say it's such a big deal.
Yeah. he's been beating this drum for a long time now, and you didn't disappoint, but so thank you for joining us here.
Yeah, we'll see you down at BPCon. We'll make sure to come over and say hi. And
yes, please.
Looking forward to your presentation. So
I would love to hang out.
Or if you listen to us for the first time or the 100th time, we appreciate review on whatever format you listen to us. Thank you to our listeners. We hope to see you guys at our upcoming event that we're having next week for celebrating 2 years, 100 podcasts, where we have 54 past podcast guests flying in to Omaha, Nebraska to come hang out with us. So appreciate that.
That might be a little bit of a reach, but they're not all flying.
No, but some are.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. But there is 54 past podcast guests coming in. So look forward to hanging out with you guys. We'll get that content out after this episode. So we're going to interview as many of those people as we can.
Yep. And catch up with them, see what they're up to since we talked to them last.
And I just want to say that you guys, it's been great podcasting with you guys for the last 2 years.
You too, buddy.
And I appreciate you guys so much. This has been a life change for me. And Pace, we just look forward to keep on watching your content and being a big fan of it. And I'm excited to have Travis Banks come speak. And then whatever we can do to support you when you do come in Omaha.
Just support me by letting me come on your 200th episode.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right.
It's already done.
Yeah. Deal.
Cool.
With that, Owen, will you see us out?
On behalf of Rhea Radio, Denlis Bertrand, and Ted Kosh, I'm Owen Dashner, and you've been listening to Pace, I Just Gotta Be Me at BP.
Morgan. Yes.
Signing off.
Later, guys.
Thanks, man. Have a great day.